Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I'm the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009 when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Les Leopold, the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour, and I just want to tell you that you'll get a rich and rewarding experience by listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book Vultures Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores, and you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
We'll be right back.
This is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on, not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
Welcome to a Sunday edition of Carson's Corner in conjunction with the CommonsProjectNetwork.com. My name is Bob Carson. We have a great show for you today. In the next hour or so, we're going to be speaking with researcher Stu Wexler. Stu has been on the program before, and he's authored a bunch of different books about some of the civil rights cases, The Awful Grace of God, and I believe the book that he authored with Larry Hancock is called Shadow Warfare, The History of America's Undeclared War. And Stu is researching some cold cases involving the Civil Rights era. And it's very, very interesting stuff. And we're going to talk to him. It's always interesting to talk to guys that really put research above all else. I mean, individuals like Lamar Waldron, who we've had on the show before, who actually once said that he had like 2 or 3 million documents in his home, and people like Larry Hancock and people like Jerry Mitchell, who have done this, who have used the Freedom of Information Act, who have actually traveled to the South and obtain documents and analyze documents, because that's what gives us the truth. That's what gives us a clear picture of what happens, and that's what contributes to the record. It's so very, very important. It really is. So we'll have him on the program maybe around 2:45, 3 o'clock here on Carson's Corner. But until then, I want to continue to talk about the book that I was talking about last week that I'm still reading. It's called They Rule, the 1% Versus Democracy. And this is very, very important. Paul Street is a really, really important author because, one of the best things I think that Paul Street does is he shows the hypocrisy within the Obama administration. He shows just how deceitful and just how empty President Obama is and was and always will be, because it's important. The corporate media is not going to point out the hypocrisy when it comes to President Obama. Like, for example, in 2011, when President Obama was kicking off his campaign, that's when the Occupy protests started. And while these individuals like myself, who are saddled with debt, are in a country with virtually no economic opportunity anymore, the United States of America has become a stratified country in which people that are poor, they're experiencing a shorter lifespan. That they're experiencing a whole host of problems with being poor. These people were gathering, and these people were questioning the system. They were, asking the right questions. They were mad at the right people, so to speak. And while this is happening, President Obama is fundraising. He's going to elite, fundraising dinners, raising money from the very wealthy people. He'll you know, offer tepid criticism to in the public arena. And, you know, this just shows the hypocrisy of President Obama. While, you know, saying in 2008 and saying in 2012, we have to do more to combat climate change. But on the other hand, golfing with someone like Jim Crane, the owner of the Houston Astros, who's a big, you know, oil and gas guy, who has no interest in preserving our landscape, has no interest whatsoever on creating a sustainable and efficient economy. But that's what we've come to expect when it comes to President Obama. Another thing that Paul Street writes about in this book, and he's not obviously the first person to write about this, is the lack of upwards mobility in the United States of America. And I think that this is important because, you know, if we understand this, if we really analyze the details and the facts and the empirical data, which shows that the United States of America is the least upwards country in terms of mobility of any of the rich countries. You know, you have a better chance of becoming rich if you're born in Iran or if you're born in Turkey. In fact, the lack of upwards mobility in the United States is comparable to what you see in, you know, the Latin American countries, which is really, really terrible. If we really cement this home with the American people, if we make them understand that, you know, your chances of becoming rich are like your chances of becoming tall in accordance with the height of your parents. In other words, you know, someone that's 6'5", 6'6", their parents are likely that height. You don't just grow to be that height. You have to have some sort of, you know, leg up at birth. Well, it's the same thing when it comes to wealthy people in America. If somebody's born into a wealthy family, if somebody is born into a family that you know, where their parents are highly educated, then that is going to correlate to how they will be as an adult. In other words, the number one determining factor of whether or not somebody is going to be rich in life is the economic status of their parents. And this has been, you know, this has been defined. This has been established. Okay. And once you start to realize that, then you start to raise class awareness among the American people. And that is very, very important to our struggle going forward. And Paul Street writes about this, and of course there was a great book about this called The Self-Made Myth, which I highly recommend everybody read. Points to the fact that, you know, the rags to riches story in America doesn't exist anymore. It's merely anecdotal. As I said, you know, the socioeconomic status of your parents is going to be a determining factor of where you will be when you enter into an adulthood. And the reason why is because the very rich, their children have needs addressed. This is very, very important. You know, chances are, if you're born into a wealthy family, chances are you're not going to have to pay for college. You're going to be introduced to elite institutions just by virtue of the fact that your parents know so many people. You know, it's like Malcolm Gladwell said, the author, where you could, you know, take a person and ask and write down 50 last names and then look at a rich person and ask them if they know, how many people they know off of that list. And you'll find that the rich people know a lot more people than poor people do. It's just the way it is. It's networking. It's almost politics. You could look at it as organizational politics. And this creates an atmosphere in which, you know, you get ahead in life, you get offered opportunity, you know, based on the people you know. And the people you know are going to be influenced by, you know, what type of money you have. I mean, it's just, I think it's common sense. But this is what we have in the United States of America is, you know, we have an elite group of people that are getting richer while everybody else is getting poorer. And what that means for the rest of us is, you know, what we're seeing right now, where the very wealthy have a tremendous amount of political power, okay? Money equals power in our society, and power is how you get things done, okay? It's, one of the reasons why the financial sector has collapsed the economy, and this happened under both Democrats and Republicans, both political parties are beholden to the financial sector. You know, Dick Durbin famously said they own the place, and he's absolutely right. And so what they did is they, used their political influence to crash the economy, got the government to bail them out, okay, to the tune of trillions of dollars. I mean, William Black, the professor, has went on record and said that we have lost $20 trillion in production. And now, the financial sector is bigger than ever, okay? They've created a continued regulatory black hole to the point where, we can't regulate them. We can't do anything, okay? The CEO bonuses, which, again, Obama didn't go after. Obama allowed these CEOs to walk away with hundreds of millions of dollars. They have created an economic system where, their money, their political influence creates, negative aspects of our society. I mean, it's almost like a sick value system, a value system disorder, in which the socially negative attributes of society become positively rewarded ventures for industry. That's one of the tenets in the Zeitgeist movement, and it's very important. But it shows you where we're at in America right now. Now, another thing that Paul Street discusses, and I think this is very important because this has really been reinforced for the last 30-plus years, really starting with Ronald Reagan, is making the rich richer, which has become the foundation of our economic system in America, giving tax cuts to the very wealthy, supply-side economic, whatever you want to call it, okay, putting business first and abiding by the notion that the self-interested pursuit of money, the narrow self-interested pursuit of money will be for the betterment of society. This produces a whole bunch of negative activities in our society, okay? And these activities, such as mergers and acquisitions, such as monopolies intruding on the, quote, private market, such as offshore tax havens, such as union busting, such as, more money when it comes to our campaigns, when it comes to, stock options. I mean, just, you could look over the last 30-plus years and see what has made the wealthy wealthy. All of this has a tremendously bad effect on the economy, and it contributes to what we're talking about a while ago, the lack of upwards mobility in America. Simply making the rich richer will basically give them the power to make you poor. I mean, it's almost common sense. No wealthy person in America is going to allow you to vote to take away their wealth. It's just the bottom line. And you want to talk about wealth distribution, okay? In the United States of America, workers are working much harder than they did, in 1979 or 1980. Okay, we are working more hours. We have less vacation time. In fact, China, the country that we love to hear about, the corporate media tells us, is a state-run economy, and it's an example of how communism doesn't work and so forth. Actually, the Chinese workers over the past 10, 15 years have actually had more raises in the minimum wage than American workers. I mean, it's really remarkable, but that is the God's honest truth in America. It's all the more reason to boycott the election. It's all the more reason to say, you know what, we're not going to be able to vote our way out of this problem. The wealthy are not going to allow us to vote on reversing income inequality. But going back to what I was just saying, you know, we're in a system now where wealth is being redistributed upwards. As Joseph Stiglitz has said, Joseph Stiglitz is the, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, economist. I mean, the guy is just brilliant. Says that the top have learned how to suck money from everybody else. Okay, now, how this is done, I mean, this is done in so many different ways. Number one, it's done using our tax code. I keep on saying on this program that the United States tax code has swelled to over 70,000 pages, okay? When the United States tax code was first enacted, federal tax, that was in 1913, and that was only a couple hundred pages. Well, now it's well over 70,000 pages. And it's well over 70,000 pages because corporations use our tax code to essentially dodge their tax bill and pass it on to us, okay? It is one of the reasons why, if you look when Ronald Reagan came into office, the average corporation was paying a much higher effective tax rate than they are now, and you and I have made the difference. Corporations view the tax code as part of their business model. They view not paying taxes in America as part of their business operations, and you've got companies like Walmart, General Electric, other massive corporations which have more economic power than most nations on the face of this earth, not paying taxes, okay? And this is how they suck money out of everybody else because, well, they're not paying taxes. We're told that we have a spending problem in the United States, okay? And we know that a deficit is the gap between spending and revenue. And so what happens as a result of that is you have President Obama, the more effective evil, you know, with this grim grand bargain, kicking 70,000 kids off of the Head Start program. What you have is students like myself paying a higher interest rate because, you know, we're told that, you know, we can't lend money to individuals looking to go to college. We just don't have the money for that, right? You have, unemployed individuals that can't get an extension for their unemployment insurance, which they've paid into their entire life. They have to essentially pay for the corporations that are not paying taxes. I mean, you know, then you could look at the corporate welfare in America, okay? This is something that I've talked about for years, and I'll continue to talk about it because it's so important. Corporate welfare in America has become more varied. It's become more bipartisan. You have the defense industry, you know, the richest zip code in America is outside of Washington, D.C. It's filled with these disgusting defense contractors that siphon, you know, 50 cents off of every dollar in federal taxes that are paid. You have companies that are just mind-bogglingly wealthy, and you know, there's no control, there's no analysis whatsoever of the money going to the defense industry. No-bid contracts, weak procurement process, indirect, direct subsidies. You have one defense program, you know, ineffective defense program costing the government hundreds of billions of dollars for the same money that we spend on these useless fighter jet programs and these useless missile defense programs and you know, just fill in the blank. We can house every homeless person in America Okay? I mean, it is absolutely true. With the money, with, you know, probably half of the money that we waste on defense in the United States, we could provide every homeless person in America with a house. We don't do that because we have to maintain scarcity. We don't do that because doing the right thing in America is not profitable. You know, socialism does not entail profits, okay, and therefore it is marginalized, even though the American public loves socialism. But, you know, corporate welfare is just running amok in America. You've got, a corporate welfare system that is being exploited by the very wealthy and in turn is making us poor. And this is why we have a system in America in which it's impossible to become wealthy. Paul Street points out that if you're born in the lower portion of the income ladder, in other words, if you're born into poverty in America, the chance of becoming a person in the upper income ladder, the top 1%, is literally 1%, okay? So you have a society in which people are losing hope of ever becoming rich. Capitalism, the material conditions of capitalism are deteriorating by the day in America. Debt has replaced paychecks, no upwards mobility. And what you have as a result is you have a country in which we find ourselves in right now, where the people of Ferguson, Missouri, are protesting an unarmed black individual being shot by the police. No accountability. You have a system in which the incarceration rate in the United States of America is greater than any country. This is a social byproduct of capitalism. You have the highest murder rate of any industrialized country. You have the greatest gap between rich and poor. You have the rate of mental illnesses skyrocketing in America. Now, a good way to explain this, and you know, you could read about this in Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson's book, The Spirit Level, but a good way to explain this to people that, you know, maybe don't study this is look at a kindergarten class, right? Okay? Let's say we have a kindergarten class of 10, 15, or maybe 20 students. Let's say 20 students, okay? And in this kindergarten class, you have toys, you have materials for a class, you have, you know, anything that you would need. But let's say that the ownership in this kindergarten class is just one or two people owning everything. One or two kids in this class owns everything. And the rest of the, you know, the 18, 19 kids, they are deprived. They have nothing. They have mere table scraps. Well, what type of environment do you think that is going to produce? I mean, let's say that you can, not that you'd want to do this, but let's say that you can empirically test this theory. You can do this experiment where you give all the possessions in this class to one or two students. Well, what's going to happen is you're going to have the children cry. You're going to have the children fight each other. Perhaps you're going to have even the children self-harm one another. And inevitably, you'll have a few children try to, you know, buddy up to the child that has all the wealth, all the possessions in the class. But you could see what type of environment this creates. You could see that the negative activities associated with that type of concentration of wealth. And that's the same thing that's playing out in the United States of America, okay? And this is how the very rich have enhanced their fortunes. I mean, you can go down the line. You can look at the labor market in America. How, you know, basically, as I said at the top of the program, we have an economic system that is designed to make the rich richer. Make the rich richer, the self-interested, narrow pursuit of money for the sake of money. Okay, that's it. The socially negative attributes of society becoming positively rewarded ventures for industry. Okay, we've allowed this to take place. This is, libertarianism is at the core of our economic policies. Okay, there's no question about this, and this is what is happening in America. It's been happening, and it's not going to change. Okay, and so you have this, and what emerges as a result of this is a loose labor market. Okay, where because we have to do what's in the interest of big business first, it's acceptable for businesses to offshore jobs. It's acceptable for mergers and acquisitions, the negative activities associated with our economic policies. It's acceptable for the continuous flow of capital as opposed to the mobility of labor in America. All of these are acceptable if you abide by the notion that we have to do what's in the interest of big business first. And so as long as we keep business profitable, as long as we keep the wealthy, then who cares? Way it goes. If you can't find a job, it's attributable to your individual initiative. If you don't have the skills to work, then you're not going to be competitive. You're not going to be desirable to employers. Okay, so now you have, and this will always happen in America, now you have a surplus of labor. You have, five or six people looking for every available job out there. You have a shadow unemployment rate that is much higher than, what we're given as part of the artificial, the benchmarks in which we use to measure our economy, the yardsticks in which we use to measure our economy, the economic abstractions, as Peter Joseph calls them. And so this really creates a system in which people are desperate. And you can look at cities like Detroit and others, which used to be the heart of manufacturing in America, and you could see these cities decimated precisely because the business community has decided that the only thing that is important in America is them getting profits. That's it. That is the only thing. Profits above people. Okay? The most important thing for these businesses is to make money. That's it. They don't care. And the way to make money is to pit our labor force versus, the labor force in Vietnam, the labor force in China, the labor force in fill in the blank. One especially candid CEO, Jack Welch, says that when he looks at manufacturing plants in the United States, he said something to the effect that he would like to put them in barges and basically ship them all over the world. And this really hurts the United States. It hurts us. Okay, it contributes to the deterioration of the material conditions of capitalism, and that's where we find ourselves right now, where we have a jobs that are not coming back to the United States, businesses that are incentivized to ship jobs overseas, and this is acceptable in the United States. This is commonplace. It's really remarkable, but this is what we have in America. And another thing that Paul Street points out in his book, and this is really important because there's no type of institutional analysis in America, okay? These questions that we're raising, the questions that the Occupy protesters were raising, were not allowed to be raised, okay? This is not allowed to be part of the discussion because once you start to reassess some assumptions that are given to us by the elite, then you start to really examine capitalism, and then you yearn for economic alternatives, and that's not allowed. I mean, that is something that the ruling class is not going to allow. But what we have here in America is always a rush to blame the individual. The capitalists want us to see this as individual problems, you know, the high poverty rate, the you know, the incarceration rate. It must be a flaw in the wiring, because the United States of America is the richest country on earth, right? I mean, this is the, quote, land of opportunity, right? I mean, you know, if you say anything other than that, then, you know, you're un-American. You're this, that, and the other thing. Whatever can lock us into accepting the status quo, the labels that corporations give us to maintain the status quo, anti-business, anti-capitalist, you know, anti-this, anti-that, pro-growth, pro-this or that. All of these are labels designed to preserve status quo. Okay, so that's something you got to say. But you've also got to look at the fact that today's workforce is more poor than ever, and yet we're the most educated of previous workforces. I mean, you could go back to 1979, and Paul Street points out that one out of every five workers had a college degree. Well, now it's one out of every three workers have a college degree. And you know, the level of inequality in America is through the roof, and it's only accelerating. But that is not comparable with other countries that are highly educated. It's not comparable with Japan, with Germany, with France. These countries also have a highly educated workforce, and yet they do not experience the level of inequality. They do not experience the social ills that we have due to our economic system in America. And that is very, very important, because the capitalists, the elites, whatever you want to call them, they will always find a way to blame us, blame the individual, because there's no end to the extent that you can blame the individual. There's just no end whatsoever. Again, the United States of America is the land of the free. We are the land of opportunity. If you can't make it in America, then there's something wrong with you. There's a flaw in the wiring. And that is very, very important, because we have not seen our wages increase at all. In fact, going back to Ronald Reagan, and it all started with Ronald Reagan, but you know what? You can make an argument that it started with Jimmy Carter in 1978. We saw the defeat of organized labor. We saw a defeat to peg the minimum wage with inflation. So, and you know, Carter bought into some of the deregulation nonsense and whatnot, regulation being law and order in America. But, you know, the top 1% of income earners, depending upon which estimate you want to look at, they've seen their income growth go from anywhere from 3 to 600%. Yet for the vast majority of Americans, we've only seen our income growth grow to 1% over the last 30 plus years. And again, this is reflective in the statistics. You could look at the average American and see a tremendous amount of debt, which again, as I said, debt has replaced paychecks in America. And that's what we have ourselves. That's what we find ourselves in right now. It's really disgusting. It really is. It makes me feel ashamed to be an American. And, you know, David Harvey, the professor, talks about what is considered a crisis in capitalism. What is considered a crisis? Well, a crisis in capitalism would be considered zero growth, no growth, right? That is basically a crisis in capitalism. But right now, because of income inequality in America, because the top 1% of income earners earn anywhere from 23 to 25% of the nation's income, they've experienced virtually all of the income growth, similar to what we saw in the lead-up to the Great Depression. And the top 1% of income earners control you know, all of the wealth. They own 50% of the nation's wealth. You have slow growth in America right now, okay, where growth now is being defined as what's being shown at the upper income ladder. In other words, we define growth using the yardsticks in which Ralph Nader talks about. He who controls the yardsticks controls the game. The economic abstractions, you know, growth, rate of inflation, GDP, all of this is supposed to correlate to the living standards of Americans. Listen, without that, let's go to Stu Wexler here. We got him on the phone right now. Stu, welcome back to Carson's Corner.
Hi, this is Hotep Kenyatta calling from New York. It's not Stu. I'm a community activist.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, yeah. I was just calling briefly to mention that we have a serious challenge both in each local community nationally and then internationally, and it does seem as though some of the same people, George Soros, House of Windsor, et cetera, have their hands in all our communities via various pimps and hoes, intellectual and of the street type, Al Sharpton, Obama, the Bush family, et cetera.
Yep.
And unless we come together on core issues that we want to address, they're going to continue to kill us off. And at the bottom, they will start continue to kill off darker people, and then they'll move up to more lighter people who are poor, socioeconomically challenged, and they'll continue going on up. And so we really have to come together.
I totally agree with you, and I like the fact that, see, you and I are on the same page because you do not distinguish between the so-called left-wing, rich people and news shapers and newsmakers and the so-called right-wing. They're all the same to all of
yeah.
us. George Soros, you're absolutely right. You bring up George Soros. George Soros was instrumental in the deregulation of Wall Street. George Soros, you know, made his fortune by manipulating financial markets. You mentioned Al Sharpton. Al Sharpton is there to uphold the system. Al Sharpton is an Obama sycophant, and we know that President Obama is the more effective evil. Now, my question is, what are we, the core issues that we can sort of come together on? You know, Ralph Nader talks about this, how who doesn't want prosperity? Who doesn't want a fair taxation system? Who doesn't want, you know, honest government? You know, we all want these things. The question is, how do we get there? And that is, you know, really the $64,000 question. I would argue, and some would argue, to reject the system entirely, withdraw your consent by not voting, and then let the system collapse. And there, you know, hopefully we can rebuild a more sustainable and efficient economic system. What do you think about that?
That is very risky, because what then happens is the same people with the guns and weapons and law enforcement will then claim the confusion as an opportunity to come in and shut down everyone. My thinking is there needs to be a simultaneous approach. While we're getting off a ship that is sinking, we still want to do as much as we can to rescue what is, you know, possible that can work in the new ship. And the ship is the analogy or the an example for our political economic system. Our system is not structured for people or the average person, nor is it structured for the plants, the trees, the animals, or sustainable life on Earth. Our system is structured for death and damnation and the rape of our environment and people. We're at an SOS phase. I mean, I keep saying it, and some of us are saying it. We're at SOS, and I don't know if people realize humanity can be wiped out. I think some people believe in the, you know, like my mother, that this is a part of God's plan, and that, you know, if we sit back and let it happen, suddenly there'll be angels and we'll all have a paradise. And my argument is always to such people that even if that is God's plan, why do we have to sit back? Meaning, where does it say in any of the holy books, sit back and do nothing, let the destruction happen and I'll come on? I don't think that's the case. I think we need to work as hard as hell to come together on core issues. You asked initially what the core issues were, and I think right in the center is children, meaning there's no future without children. So all children deserve the best of everything, education, legal coverage, medical coverage, decent food, decent housing, every child on the planet. We can afford it. The problem is the oil, the warmongers, the diamond stealers don't want us to think we can afford it. So then people say, oh, we can't afford it. No, we can. Breakfast, lunch, dinner for every child on the planet that wants it. And if you can afford more, you don't go in for it, you know? Medical coverage, a lawyer. Why should a poor family with children's challenges have to worry about paying for a lawyer? We should have a right. team of brilliant lawyers available. And the same thing for, I would say, education. Why should it be a system if I have an Ivy League degree and you have a degree but it's not from an Ivy League institution, corporations look at me as more of a higher candidate to consider? It's preposterous. So then we set up a system where the rich continue to get the best of the best. And other than a few tokens that enter into Harvard and Yale and Princeton, and then everyone thinks that the scales are balanced. They're not. They're called tokens for a reason. They're outliers. So, but we're at SOS, Save Our Souls, and if we can do it, great. If not, I think as a civilization, we're done.
Well, look, that's very, very well said, brother. I was absorbing what you're saying, and you're spot on, and you mentioned so many different things, but it all comes back to, I think, the system in which, you know, we find ourselves in. And, you know, there's the folks over in the Zeitgeist Movement that I've really been – I don't know if you're familiar with any of the work.
Yeah,
because it sounds like it. It definitely sounds like, you know, and you know, what Peter Joseph and some can really expand on is the idea that if we are more in tune with nature, okay, we realize that sustainability and efficiency cannot be enemies of the marketplace. They have to be the very foundation of the marketplace. And right now, we have an economic system that demands consumption, and the more consumption, the better. And in order for us to consume more, it is critical that things break down, that things become inferior. And this really, I think, sets the tone to a large extent as far as why we find ourselves in the position that we're in right now. I mean, you know, everything is built that we don't have a market system. We don't have an economy. We have an anti-economy, and I really do believe that. And so my goal with this program, and I'm sure as an intellectual like yourself, your goal to a certain extent is to raise awareness, to try to, you know, make people think differently, make people sort of, you know, reevaluate some of the assumptions that are given to us. And once we develop that, once we form, I think, a higher level of consciousness, and as you know, you point out, we realize that we are in SOS stage, the conditions of capitalism deteriorate, people are inevitably going to look for an alternative. You know, I would have thought that this would have taken place in 2008. We had the financial collapse. Right, the economy went into a tailspin, and President Obama, with his rhetoric, and President Obama, you know, with his look, his appearance, and his family, and everything, was supposed to be the alternative to, I want to say, you know, that form of capitalism, or the alternative to the quote Bush economy. But you know what? Obviously, President Obama has been the alternative, and now to me, it's like we have to wait until the next collapse. But you know, the next time it may be worse than what happened in 2008. It may go back to what we saw during the Great Depression. I don't know, but that's what I think is going to have to happen, is that the American people are not going to really react. We're not going to, you know, take charge unless it gets so bad, the conditions get so bad, and you know, we'll be just yearning for any alternative.
Yeah, and sadly, that any alternative tends to be us turning on each other, meaning one group. Not that some groups don't have kind of a bit more, in my opinion, responsibility for what is happening. However, one, we'll turn on Mexicans, and then blacks will definitely turn on whites because, you know, historically that's been what black folks have gone through. But then the average white will say, it's not us. It's the people on the top and you lazy people sitting around listening to that rap music, right? And that will then lead to the same cycle, and the system will come in with a female president. And she will say, I love you all. I'm a female. And guess what? After that, the next 4 years, a native Indian with feathers and a, you know, a sword or whatever, and come out doing the rain dance, and they all are part of the same system. We don't have really independent people that become potential presidents, because to be a president, it takes millions of dollars just to get to a certain level. So how is an average community activist or someone that really cares, a mother, homeless mother that really was a former principal and now is homeless, but wants to help to run the country? She will have no chance in hell. None. Zero.
No.
We're in bad shape, and I live in a what's called African-American community that is going through gentrification now, and there's two groups, the people moving in who tend to be white, but not always, right? And then the average black or Latino who is very annoyed and stressed because they're losing their homes. So it's a, they don't see the invisible force in the middle that is pitting the two groups against each other.
I think what's happening now is, you know, we have 8 years of President Obama, right? And what I've been saying on this program, because I started out supporting President Obama, and I went from 2008 supporting him to basically almost becoming a election boycott advocate. And now what I'm saying is what I think is happening now, the alternative now that we have 8 years of President Obama, and the elites want us to think that President Obama was somehow, you know, on the left side of things, is the alternative is going to be for more privatization. The alternative is going to be to move us towards fascism, because what I believe is I believe that the United States of America is moving towards fascism. I believe that the countervailing institutions in America are being just third away, and we know this, unions in America, any type of worker mobility, any type of worker solidarity is outlawed, and that's getting worse. I mean, we're seeing the public sector unions being attacked. We see the corporate state expand, you know, corporations getting larger and larger and larger, getting more and more and more rights. You know, we could look at so many different examples of that. And dissent is just being, you know, nullified. I mean, it's – and so, you know, that's what I think is we're moving towards a fascist state. And unfortunately, the elites can present this to the American public as an alternative to what we've seen over the last 8 years. You know, we had President Obama who was more in line with Ronald Reagan, but the elites don't want to tell us that. So now – The solution is, the alternative is to be more fiscally conservative, more willing to spend money on defense, and go on and on and on. And it's structural adjustment. That's what it would come down to. We are being structurally adjusted in America.
Can I say that I think we are already in a fascist state, and I think that it may be hard for some listeners to believe, but we're still on a plantation. It's just that cotton and tea and, you know, things like that are no longer as critical for humans to pick, because Eli Whitney and other technological inventions made it, you know, not less necessary. I have a very outside-the-box proposal that I've been saying. I've been suggesting on a few shows and in some of my publications that what we need to do is actually form our own government, a shadow government, meaning we pick a president, we pick a vice president, we pick a mayor. And same thing for economics. We start to say, okay, this is what Wall Street is doing, so let's pick some brilliant financial brains to look at and evaluate the formulas that are being put out that are claimed to be related to GDP, GNP, whatever you say. Because us depending on them for radio, for TV, for banking, for politics is preposterous. They have proven to be not trustworthy. So while we go out and vote, hopefully intelligently, we then go to our own consuls. And our council vote, and then our president of our council goes and meets with President Obama and says, look, I've got 100 million people that voted for me. There's so many people tired, I'm telling you, tired. Some people ready to revolt, they're so tired.
But let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
If we set up our own government, and I'm with you, how do you get to that point? Would you urge people not to participate in the electoral system?
No, I think both. Here's why. Because if we don't have our hands on the runaway car as we migrate away from it, the runaway car will come and smash back into us. So it's still great to have some say in the economic process. After all, they're taking our tax money. But simultaneously, I think it's so critical that people that are just sick and tired say, look, if we keep doing the same thing, it's a sign of insanity. So why don't we,
yep.
You know, I already have about 50 people. By the way, when I say I, it's not that it's me. The team will then vote whoever is in charge, whoever. It doesn't matter. It's not about ego. It's about how can we save the nation and save the planet. And that's really something that people should start thinking about. Isn't it time for – I don't mean shadow government in the very, you know, nefarious.
Right.
And, you know, I'm just talking about, hey, they've got a – they set up a new position, right? We say, oh, great, we'll set up a new position, have about 20 candidates, have people vote on it, have debates, and then have that person promoted on radio shows, and they say, this is our director of technology. This is our director of anti-racism. This is our director of anti-war. So when they put forward one of their generals, we may be able to put our person on to say, well, actually, my research team indicates yada, 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 yada. We've got to go way outside this waiting on Superman type mindset, because we're at almost the end. Look at the nuclear pollution in the water. And in the air, we've got pollution. We're the frog burning alive.
We have no intrinsic value. Hedges said that corporations have no, or human beings have no intrinsic value to corporations, and that's what I believe. Now, listen, thanks for the call. You mentioned that you have a publication or you have some sort of a work online that people can view.
Yes, definitely. Hotep Kenyatta. Hotep, it's an Egyptian word for peace, and Kenyatta, Kenyatta, after Jomo Kenyatta, because I do believe that we also need to have a strong self-defense concept, meaning if we sit down and think that this old God is going to politely sit back and hand over the reins without us thinking, okay, how do we make sure our families are safe from being kidnapped or poisoned, that type of stuff, it wouldn't be a wise move. So Hotep Kenyatta, we have several products coming out that are free to the public that deal with how we can solve these problems. And by the way, I'm not the only one. There's some other folks that are with me who have their own movements, but we come together occasionally and discuss these issues. And I'm thankful for this chance to talk to you. I have children, and I'm looking to make a better world. And some of us have to be willing to, you know, put it on the line and do that.
Well, listen, I'm sorry to ask you. Can you spell that? Because I'm trying to find this now.
Oh, sorry. Hotep. H-O-T like Tom, E like Edward, P like Peter, and then Kenyatta, K like King, E-N like Nancy, Y-A, T like Tom, T like Tom,
gotcha.
A. And the middle
initial
is Yan, for Yamaguchi Apollo Nirvana, just out of respect for people that may have different belief systems when it comes to religion. So that's the middle name, Yan, Yamaguchi Apollo Nirvana.
Okay. I just sent you a friend's request, my friend.
Oh, thank you, brother.
On Facebook. Listen, the call was inspiring, man. You got a lot of things to say, a lot of wisdom, and I really hope that we could work together. Hope that you'll call in sometime, and hopefully we can collaborate in the future, my friend.
Thank you, brother, and stay strong. We have to do something, and we will. We have it all in our brains and in our spirits. Let's just do it. Thanks so much. Much love.
Take care, brother. So long.
Thank you. Peace.
Yeah, so, you know, Tom Hartman, he had the smartest callers. I don't know. I think I may have the smartest callers. But anyway, with that, let's go to Stu Wexler here. Stu, welcome back to Carson's Corner.
Hi, Bob. How you doing?
Good, good, good. Stu is the author of the book The Awful Grace of God, Religious Terrorism, White Supremacy, and the Unsolved Murder of Martin Luther King Jr., just recently, earlier this year, I believe, Shadow Warfare, The History of America's Undeclared War. As I've said, both books are extremely relevant to the discussion that we're having. And Stu has been working on some cold cases And I want to talk to him about that and anything else that he's got going on. So just kind of, if you would, Stu, take it away.
Well, hi again, and hi to the audience. I've been going back the last couple of years and actually applying a lot of the sort of patterns and analysis that I did for the King book in Awful Grace of God to other famous civil rights cold cases. So I've analyzed the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in September of 1963, and very recently the investigative reporter Jerry Mitchell was kind enough to let me guest blog for him, and I wrote about some interesting new insights into the Mississippi burning killings. And it all comes back to a few things. One, a few things emerge out of this. The first is that there are elements to the motivations behind these crimes that I don't think have really adequately been explored anywhere.
Uh-huh.
That could generate potentially new leads. I, for instance, especially in the Birmingham bombing case, that definitely needs to be reexamined with that mindset and that sort of those motivations in mind. And those are specifically the idea that a radical, very distorted view of Christianity was being used as motivation for some of the senior members of white supremacist groups, not just in the 60s, I submit to you, after it as well, to really ratchet up racial violence, not for the same reasons as the people who are carrying it out necessarily, the, you know, everyday, what we call clucker, Ku Klux Klan member,
mm-hmm.
but to try and provoke even greater violence and hopefully in their minds a cycle of retaliation to bring about what they believe to be was a race war. So a lot of my work has focused on that. I even published an e-book, it's available on Nook, very small, called Rebels, Red Baiters, and Religious Radicals, to deal with my research in the Birmingham bombing. And then separately and independently, we could talk about this too if you'd like, with Larry Hancock taking the lead, my co-author on Awful Grace of God, we put out a book that deals with the history of the CIA's not really just the CIA, America's sort of secret wars around the world for the past 50, 60 years.
Yeah, I think that, you know, let's go back to, you mentioned that you were interested in reevaluating some of the aspects of the case. What do you think, with regards to this bombing that you mentioned, what do you think needs to be reevaluated? What type of clues and what type of theories have you come up with that could possibly lead us to, you know, finding out who did this?
Well, in the case of the Birmingham bombing, I think we have a very good idea as to who performed the actual bombing. And a handful of those people were arrested and convicted, even in the 2000s, which I think is very important for people to understand. But there are layers of people above them that need to be looked at much more seriously. And the other sort of thing that emerges from, and a very unfortunate thing that emerges from my investigation of King and these other two crimes, is that there's not only an ignorance of what's happening. In some cases, the government appears to be willfully hiding things connected to these people, and not because I think the government necessarily ordered anything.
Right.
But in the case of the Birmingham bombing, there's very good reason to suspect that a very ardent racist by the name of J.B. Stoner may have had something to do with it, may have even masterminded it.
Right.
Well, even as of a couple of days ago, my research indicated that the government had tapped his phone. Now, he was a lawyer for all sorts of racists, including eventually James Earl Ray. Hoover
right.
obtained a permission to do an open-ended ongoing wiretap of his law office Now, you could imagine there's a lot of reasons why the FBI might want to hide that fact,
right,
including the possibility that they went after people with information they obtained from that tap, which would have been unconstitutional. I just found out 2 days ago that my suspicions are valid in the sense that there are 500-some-odd pages of J.B. Stoner that are going to be redacted that I'm going to go look at within the next month. And they're redacted because they were obtained via wiretap.
Right.
So what's on those wiretaps? That's a fascinating thing. The FBI, in other matters, withheld wiretaps that convicted those guys in the 2000s. Tommy Blanton was one of the guys who was convicted. They withheld wiretaps on that for 40 years. They withheld the information to convict Dynamite Bob Chambliss for 15 years, basically. So there's a lot of elements in all of these cases I'm looking at where it appears like the FBI, to protect sources and methods, has withheld information that, for all we know, could result in other people going to jail. Again, somebody went to jail for this thing, for the Birmingham bombing in 2001.
Right.
Mississippi burning killings, 2005. So these things are not dead issues. There are people who can still go to jail.
Now, yeah, and you do not believe that the government was trying to hide anything, or the government withheld all this information because anything nefarious. It was just more to protect sources. But could it possibly be that the government withheld so much of, and so much is still being withheld? You know, you mentioned that the 500 pages of phone records from J.B. Stoner. Could it be that the government is embarrassed, perhaps, by some of maybe incompetence, or maybe possibly some of its involvement?
Well, I think what we may find out is that people that the government had turned into informants, and this will be, for those of your listeners who are familiar with it, it'll be reminiscent of the Whitey Bulger case, mm-hmm. that people they had turned into informants in Klan matters, for my purposes, wound up participating in these crimes. There's this impression that people get from watching, movies and TV, that when the FBI infiltrates an organization, it's some guy who, is a deep cover guy who really is an everyday apple pie and hot dog American who is pretending to be a member of the Ku Klux Klan and infiltrating the group. The reality is most informants are going to be people who were KKK members, and the FBI gets some kind of evidence against them and leverages them into becoming informants. And when that happens, those people, don't suddenly become racial egalitarians overnight.
Right.
They're very apt to be participating in racial crimes because they were racists.
Right.
So I think a lot of part of what we may be seeing is a protection of informants, very high-level potential informants, who are engaged in some of these crimes, and the FBI does not want to disclose their association with those people. I think there's good reason to think, for instance, in a lot of the Mississippi violence, that there are people who they are trying to protect.
Now, I want to talk about the Kennedy administration, because you and Larry and Lamar, you guys are really authorities, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many others, when it comes to researching some of the things that we're talking about here. How did the Kennedy administration react to King and some of the other civil rights figures? I mean, I've kind of heard different things over the years that, there was some support on the part of the Kennedy administration, but yet, there was some backdoor stuff, some stuff going on behind the scenes to try to undermine King and the other, for political reasons and everything like that. I mean, what I'm trying to get across here is, what we're talking about from the government, was this basically a bipartisan, you know, suppression, a bipartisan reaction to the civil rights investigations, you know, the investigations of the murders, or is this, you know, were the Democrats a little bit more sympathetic to, you know, finding out who committed, you know, some of these murders and fully investigating them?
Well, if anything, during the Kennedy administration, especially your Southern Democrats, it's probably not true of your Northern Democrats, but your Southern Democrats would be the people who would be your enemy in the whole thing. I mean, prior to the Civil Rights Act of 64, Democratic Party, the most powerful coalition probably within the Democratic Party, were Yellow Dog Southern Democrats who were obviously pro-segregation, pro-Jim Crow. In the case of the Kennedys, I think, and this goes for a lot of what happens with John Kennedy, it's a case of evolution. If you look at the early part of the Kennedy administration, first off, Kennedy's afraid of what sort of these actions and civil disobedience down south will do, A, to his reelection chances, and B, to the Southern coalition that would be important to passing his legislative agenda. So in some ways, he may be publicly sympathetic to some of what happens in the civil rights movement, but
right.
Early on in his administration, there are even things that he does behind the scenes, especially to groups like the Freedom Riders,
right.
that undermined what some of what the civil rights activists were looking to do. He remember, and I try and put this out to my students, unlike Lyndon Johnson, who at least on a socioeconomic level had sympathy for African Americans, John Kennedy and the Kennedys did not really grow up surrounded by African Americans.
Right.
By the time 63 runs around, two things have happened. On the unfortunate side of things, Bobby Kennedy has basically approved, he's been strong-armed by J. Edgar Hoover, wiretaps on Martin Luther King and other civil rights
right.
leaders. But on the flip, the Kennedys have finally, I think, even constitutionally, I mean constitutionally inside themselves, shifted more and more in favor of the civil rights movement. And Kennedy, of course, is the first to propose a civil rights act not long before he dies. And he gives a famous speech not long before Medgar Evers is shot in favor of civil rights. So they evolve to the good side before it's all said and done. But there's issues with both domestic politics, and then there's also issues of Cold War foreign policy. And the civil rights activists knew this. You could go a long way towards pressuring the executive to do something on civil rights by embarrassing America around the world in the Cold War. And, you know, non-aligned countries seeing how we treated African Americans in our country, the people in the civil rights movement knew that that was something that was in their favor. So when they socialized the conflict, they pushed for that. But that's for the same reason you got pushed back by the Kennedy administration trying to, you know, lower the PR damage from it.
So you're going to go down, I guess, down south to try to get J.B. Stoner's phone records, which is could produce valuable information. What else are you working on? What other are you working on? Anything else that would fall under?
You know,
right now,
my big effort is to try and turn a lot of my research, especially on King's murder, into a documentary. So it's called. I can explain the reasons behind it. I'm calling this Killing King. So the groundwork for it has already been put together. The big thing that has to be done is I have to get a lot of the witnesses who I've already interviewed and have on audio tape and things like that, I have to get them on film. So right now I'm doing an Indiegogo campaign.
Uh-huh.
If they go to my Twitter account at Justice for King, and that's an F-O-R, not four, so Justice for King is my Twitter account, or they friend me on Facebook, or the real simple Indiegogo is IGG.me/@ /killingking. So igg.me/at/killingking. They can find my Indiegogo campaign. It's also on my Twitter if they want to look for it there. I'm in, was nominated actually just for a Facebook, the Docurama, which is a Facebook group that promotes documentaries. I was one of four trailers that they selected and crowdfunding projects to try for a contest. And today is the last day. So if you go to Docurama Films and Docufunding, you can vote there. That's the big push. The big push is to try and get this into a documentary, because my big push is ultimately my sort of first goal is King. It is to try and get the government to reopen the case. You mentioned files. Over 90% of Congress's files from their 70s investigation of the Kennedy assassination have been released. 0% of the King files have been. So they ran a concurrent investigation, and millions of files on Kennedy have been released. 0 from that investigation on King. And that's unacceptable. There are fingerprints that can be run through the digital system. They haven't been run through. That's unacceptable. The fact that the King case is one of the only civil rights cold cases that has not been reopened by the Justice Department, that's unacceptable. And if my book, The Awful Grace of God, didn't get that motivated, my hope is that the documentary will push that.
Now, let me ask you, what type of, and I guess the fact that they released 0% of the King files, that's disturbing in itself. And I guess that would probably go back to the reasons we were discussing earlier, or I don't know, but I can only presume. What type of reaction, I mean, have you gotten any type of reaction from, because you'd figure someone, we were criticizing, a caller just called, and we were criticizing Al Sharpton, obviously for what I would think are rightful reasons. But have you gotten any type of reaction? You would think that someone like Sharpton or Jesse Jackson or any of these, you know, so-called civil rights leaders would be interested in putting pressure on the government to have these files released, because the work that you're doing is so important, because it creates this is history. I mean, this is a search for the truth, and this entails getting documents released to the American public. So what type of reaction have you had from the real power brokers out there, people like Sharpton, people like Jesse Jackson, who are wired into, you know, the Democratic Party, you're wired into the Justice Department, and so on and so forth?
I've sent out tweets and emails to the folks you characterize as power brokers, and whereas I've gotten feedback in other places, I've even gotten into Boston Globe, I've gotten into USA Today on some of these matters, I have not gotten any response from the Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, Joe Madison, Cornel West of the world. And I would really hope that they would take this on. I understand to some extent why there's some trepidation about files related to King. The fear that a lot of the garbage that J. Edgar Hoover collected on him would get out. But the majority of the stuff I'm looking for is investigative files. And the only thing we have right now are the stuff the FBI released, you know, in response to FOIAs from their own headquarters file. Congress did their own investigation of the case, and that stuff is sealed for decades. I've tried to get, you know, let me tell you, the Justice Department doesn't even have to release it. All we need is somebody to, on the file front, is to get the clerk of the House of Representatives to release those files. And I have contacted her and written her directly via my congressman, and the clerk refuses to do it. That's the only person that's needed. And if Congress was worried about, you know, derogatory information coming out on King, they could do what was done with Kennedy and create a group that would sift that garbage out and just give us the stuff related to his murder.
And you know what? Even if, let's say for argument's sake, that information did come out on King, and you know we know the efforts on the part of J. Edgar Hoover and you know what he did, how he hated King and you know, but even if it did, I think that Dr. King, the only people that would be trying to use that information to discredit Dr. King would be the individuals that are sympathetic with the Klan, the individuals that, you know, want to minimize.
Well, I agree with you 100%. I think people forget just how much King has become, and it probably is a result of some of the distortion of his crusade, but Glenn Beck did a Washington, D.C.
right.
get-together for King. He loves King. I mean, King's the only person who could get Glenn Beck and Jesse Jackson to agree on something, and that's that they love King. So
yeah,
I think it's an overblown fear that, like, Tea Party folks or something are going to go after Martin Luther King. Everybody has appropriated King for their purposes, rightly or wrongly.
I mean, Glenn Beck, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't think he would overtly use any material that came out in a way to try to. But I think he would try to. He's already, in my opinion, undermined Dr. King's work and kind of mischaracterized what Dr. King is for. And you know, Glenn Beck is on record as saying that he still feels we're in a civil rights struggle, only the races have been reversed. And that's what type of person that I think you're dealing with.
I'm not trying to defend him. I agree with you 100%. I think he's distorted everything that King did after 1964, especially. But he wouldn't attack him because he's trying to use him for his own ends. I don't think, in other words, there's a real fear that people will go after King's personal. For one thing, a lot of that stuff has already basically come out.
Right.
And then for the other thing is, I think people have appropriated him. And now he's beloved. If he was controversial in 1968, which he was when he died, he was incredibly controversial, more than anybody wants to remember. He's far less
radical
today.
Still, I mean,
absolutely.
Towards the end, which is good, which is and that's one theory is that when he spoke out against Vietnam and everything, he really started to talk about, you know, the poor, the plight of the poor in America and capitalism and everything, and then his involvement with organized labor, and that essentially made him a target. And you know,
I would submit to you, I always try and say to people, I think that with that theory, people give too much credit to the American people and not enough credit to King. And what I mean by that is, he really hurt his popularity, especially with white Americans. He really hurt his influence in Washington, D.C. when he took those stances. In other words, in 67 and 68, he actually was at the lowest ebb of his influence because he took those stances. And the Poor People's Campaign was actually struggling quite a bit before he died. And only really picked up in part as a result of his death, almost the martyr situation. Killing King in 68, if you're the powers that be, would actually induce, and did induce in many ways, the one thing you were fearing the most then, which was domestic sort of radicalism. King was, you know, one of the only voices still, powerful voices still left for nonviolence. The entire national security apparatus had been geared towards, you know, basically trying to stop a domestic Tet offensive, however paranoid that might be. But there were quite a bit of, you know, urban chaos.
Well, yeah.
And so...
killing
King, I try and explain, if somebody told me that the government killed King in 1964, I would be a lot more open to it than somebody telling me that the government killed King in 1968, because it would be eliciting the very problems that they were trying to avoid in 68. But that's just my two cents.
Now, I want to talk about your other work that you got going on. You mentioned the CIA secret wars across the world and everything. And, you know, this is touched upon by John Perkins, who wrote a book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And he chronicles how, you know, he went over to other countries and leaders of other countries and tried to bribe them economically. And when they wouldn't comply with his bribe, when they couldn't be corrupted, then they send in, you know, the enforcers. They send in, you know, CIA just forces that ultimately take them out. I mean, you could look at Omar Trujillo, I forget how to pronounce his name. It's been a while since I studied. And you could look at other leaders, too. I mean, you can go back to 1953 with Mossadegh. We overthrew Mossadegh after he promised to nationalize the oil field and promised to, you know, to advocate economic policies that would benefit the people. You can go to look at our involvement in Chile and with Augusto Pinochet and Salvador Allende. You could just go down the line. And I don't think this is important work on your part, because I don't think that the American people is really aware just how many wars that we've participated in, how many democratically elected governments we've overthrown.
It was amazing when I entered into the research the number of what we describe as secret wars. It's dozens. And you know, we go back, as crazy as this sounds, even prior to the CIA, and the CIA and U.S. Special Forces now, you know, for the last 30, 40 years have both sort of engaged, sometimes with each other's, you know, in conjunction with each other. You go back to FDR. Probably the very first secret war we fought was pre-World War II in China against the Japanese. And, you know, what happens there is the template, even down to the people who encouraged it, including some very prominent business people like William Pauley, the template for future secret wars was really set with that. And then you get very early on in their 50s, you get a secret war in Guatemala.
Jacob Arbenz.
And that went so well by the standards of what you would, you know, if you were the powers to be, that it became almost like du jour in the government and president. And this is something that gets ignored a lot. It's not like it's these rogue, off-the-book stuff that's happening. President after president has made use of those type of operations to accomplish foreign policy goals, to basically give Congress cover, to give themselves cover, and to not really have to push it before the American people.
Well, that's true. What about in East Timor, too? Noam Chomsky.
Oh, yeah, in Indonesia, in Laos, in Vietnam, in Burma, in the Congo, in Algeria. Our book, basically, Shadow Warfare, goes through all of them, and what you find, you know, our book really doesn't do a lot of moralizing, but in terms of the action, we explain more of the why and the how, and then the, you know, does it work? And just as a pure practical matter, it's these things very rarely work. Either in the even if they work short term, they create blowback in the long term. And by work, I mean work in the interests of the people who started them, not even talking about from a moral sense. But you go, you know, think, you know, item by item, even Afghanistan, which was a secret war that a lot of people do know about, in the, you know, late 70s, early 80s, the ultimate outcome of that, based because of the way we handled it, is what we're dealing with now in the world, both in Afghanistan and with terrorism. So it's interesting in terms of the how and the why, and it's also, you know, worth, again, as you said, the American people need to maybe understand just how often it happens. I'll give you one quick thing, kind of drives me a little bit crazy, is the recent stuff that Hillary Clinton, the comments she made in relation to Syria. There's very good reason to think, and we discuss it in our book, and because it doesn't fit the narrative of either the left or the right, and I shouldn't say the left, I should say liberals, liberal talk show, talk radio, or liberal news, or the right, that Benghazi, that what was happening there, that in fact what Ambassador Stevens was up to at the time, and this is not to try and, you know, disparage him, we were, in fact, doing what we've done over and over again, and we write in our book, we were supplying the militants in Syria with secret weapons as part of the, basically what amounts to a secret war. And we were doing it out of Libya. And there's good reason to believe that was happening, and that that may have been part of the motivation for the attack in Benghazi. But you don't ever hear that. And so when you look at ISIS, it's quite possibly the exact opposite of what Hillary Clinton said. ISIS may be in part where they are now because we weren't adequately directing where the weapons were going in that rebellion in Syria, and they fell into the hands of ISIS.
Yeah, and ISIS is likely received training. I think at the time, one of our invasions of Iraq, either the first, I think it was the first invasion, where you had something like 500 or 600,000 Iraqi military personnel that, you know, were let go, were basically disbanded. And
that's the second. That was one of the huge mistakes of the Bush administration. And let's even play along and say you could go into Iraq, which is a whole other debate.
Right.
Tremendous mistake with disbanding the Iraqi army, debathifying the government there. Huge mistakes. And you're absolutely right. You left insurgents when you disbanded that army. You just created a major insurgency by doing that. And
yeah,
I'm sure
exactly.
Some of that involves with ISIS as well.
Yeah, because some of the attacks that they're launching are, you know, they clearly require a certain amount of training. My question to you, though, Stu, is looking at all of these secret wars, it seems to me that, as someone who's not studied it as much, obviously, as you have, just kind of on the periphery of things, it seems to me that economic systems have a great deal to do with our involvement in these countries. I mentioned Chile, for example. At the time, in the early 1970s, Chile was moving towards socialism. You had Salvador Allende in that country, and he was one of, I believe, three socialist candidates that had the support of the people solidly behind him. And then, you know, we support a right-wing dictator in Augusto Pinochet, and you know, Pinochet's atrocities are well known. You could look at what's going on in Russia right now, where we're offering support to, you know, the government in Ukraine, which is, you know, by some descriptions, a fascist government. I often wonder if they were advocating, you know, communism, would we be involved in that conflict on the side that we're on right now? You could look at other, you know, I mentioned Panama, Omar Torrijos, or Omar Torrijos.
You're talking about Rafael Trujillo in the Dominican?
Yeah, he was the He was the guy that was going to turn over. He took control
yes.
of the canal.
Trujillo, yes, in the Dominican
yes.
Republic.
And
well, to go where you're saying a large number of our secret wars, for a lot of reasons, were fought during the Cold War. So economics is obviously going to be a huge element of it, because the degree to which any country shifts or is seen as shifting to the Soviet orbit before 1991 especially, we had, depending on who was president, very much a real politik going on, where we, as long as it's a dictator, it's our dictator, as long as it's not a communist dictator.
Right.
And the problem for us during the, if you want to call it again, the issue for why you get so many secret wars during the Cold War is a couple of things are going on. First off, you don't want things to escalate into World War III. But the second thing that you do secret wars is because it looks really bad for the United States to be intervening in the Third World, in a non-aligned world, when the very propaganda, and in many ways it wasn't propaganda, that the Soviets were using were that the Americans were imperialists. So secret wars in part emerge in that Cold War atmosphere. And then, as you say, I mean, a lot of behind-the-scenes power brokers in these things, advisors to the presidents, your consiglieres, are major business people, people like in United Fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, they don't want the nationalization and confiscation of their property. So they push for these involvements. They definitely have an influence. And, of course, because communism is such a political ideology is so intricately associated with economics, time after time where we go with the secret wars is places where appear to be shifting in that direction. And it does become – we do get quite a bit, as I was saying before, of blowback. And things that, we look the other way because of, because we're willing to do anything but communism. And, I'm sympathetic to the arguments of people who worry about what the communists might have done, because they weren't the friendliest people in some of the places they took over. But, by and large, it was an issue of, not exactly adhering to the idea of self-determination.
Just a quick correction here. Yeah, it was Omar Torrijos. I'm looking at it now online. He was the unofficial leader of Panama.
Talking about Panama. I thought you were talking about Trujillo in the Dominican. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to get the pronunciation correct, because I kind of butchered his name, but I was just going off memory there. But your point is well taken, and I think one of the things that Jeremy Scahill and his work and Glenn Greenwald and Edward Snowden, they try to do is to reveal the activity of our government and exactly to the extent of which our government is going outside of the box to try to collect information about Americans, to try to basically infiltrate other governments. All of this is becoming public knowledge now because of the internet, but still I feel that the American people there's a tremendous amount of apathy when it comes to things like that. It's unfortunate, and I believe to a certain extent it's by design, but it's the way it is. It is. Now I want to talk about today's climate. I kind of want to shift gears here, and
mm-hmm.
as someone who has studied racism to a large extent, who continues to study it and reviews the civil rights documents and murders into civil rights leaders and whatnot, how do you see racism today. How does this all compare to what we saw in the 1960s? Because I just recently read a book. It was called Dog Whistle Politics by Ian Haney Lopez. And it was really a tremendous book on race relations in America. And it discusses how the use of dog whistle politics, which really, you know, you could almost trace back to Lee Atwater. I had Lamar Waldron on this program a couple of years ago, actually probably 3 years ago, and we spoke about this, how, you know, it became unfashionable to use the N-word. And so instead of using the N-word, you talk about things like, you know, welfare recipients. You talk about things like tax cuts. And Ronald Reagan really understood this well because, you know, in 1980, Ronald Reagan used to give a speech about the young buck at the supermarket buying a T-bone steak while you're waiting behind him. You know, he's buying a T-bone steak using welfare benefits from the government, and you, the hard-earned, you know, the hard-working taxpayer, essentially have to pay for his T-bone steak. And this was considered a racial provocation. And so then Reagan, instead of using the term young buck, he switched it to young fella. But everybody knew what he was talking about, the minority. You know, we have the minority who can work but can't work. You have the government subsidizing the minority. And then you have you, the hardworking taxpayer. And this is sort of, been standard operating procedure for both parties. And you have someone like Mitt Romney in 2012 talking about 47% of Americans who can't take personal responsibility for themselves. What he's saying there is these people don't deserve government help. They're like minorities. And that message resonates with so many white Americans to the point where you have the Republican Party, which gets its electoral support from 90% of white America, and 98% of representation of Republicans in the House and Senate are from white people. And so what is your take on how racism compares to, you know, what we saw in the civil rights era and how it's adapted?
Well, I mean, for one thing, I think you're absolutely right in terms of explicit versus implicit racism. And it goes even further back than that. The Southern strategy, which is really a concoction of Nixon based on an analysis done by a political scientist by the name of Kevin Phillips. And what it basically boils down to, and it's sad that it boils down to this, is first off the observation that Atwater made, which is, I believe he even referenced late 1960s, is you can't be explicitly racist. You can't drop the N-bomb in American politics anymore. But what Phillips indicated and what Nixon took to another level was there's this trade-off. If you appeal to minority groups and their concerns, you're going to run the risk of alienating, unfortunately, and this is, I'm talking late 1960s especially here, white working class Americans. There's always that tension. That tension goes back centuries, right? And even possibly other minority groups. Right, so Nixon made a raw calculation, which is I'd rather have 45 to 50% of the, you know, or whatever of the electorate in terms of working class Americans than the 8 to 12% represented by African Americans. So I'm going to use a campaign against crime and order, which unfortunately has a racial trigger in this country, and I'm going to go after things like, and especially people who followed Nixon, I'm going to go after the welfare state because those things trigger implicit. And there are actually studies. If you ask Americans two questions that follow up on each other, the first would be, in terms of pure numbers, not proportion, but pure numbers, who receives more welfare benefits, white Americans or black Americans? And then ask them, what is their opinion on welfare? The correlation between people who incorrectly say that in terms of raw number, not proportion, raw number, more black Americans receive welfare benefits. The opposite is true. If people think that, their opposition to welfare is much, much higher. It's like, wait, like 30, 40% higher. If they correctly say that raw numbers, white Americans actually receive more welfare benefits, they're much more favorable to welfare. So what's happening there is welfare is serving as a proxy for race.
Exactly.
For a lot of people. Just as crime served as a proxy for race and order and for Nixon. So now I think we've come a long way, but the implicit racism is still something. I mean, they're even measuring it at Harvard. They're measuring it subconsciously.
It also serves as a proxy for the very wealthy, because what Reagan did after he gave the speech and after he gave his famous welfare queen speech is he proposed he enacted a $1 trillion tax cut. Which essentially transferred a tremendous amount of wealth to the top 1%. And so, you know, we talk about food stamps. Food stamps have become a symbol among white Americans as the abuse of government, when in actuality, food stamps spending is a much lower percentage of the federal budget than things like defense spending, things like corporate welfare. And corporate welfare also plays into it in the sense that Americans do not understand the amount of welfare that goes to corporations. And when we say welfare, we're talking about subsidies, indirect or direct, that benefit corporations. I mean, I can give you a dozen examples of corporate welfare. And so
subsidies are, yes.
And so
subsidies
this is,
are out of control.
And I want to read a comment from somebody in our chat room. Flycatch, blacks are nothing more than pawns on the chessboard. They vote for those who will take care of them. Yes, there are a handful that rise above the majority, but they are far and few between. Blacks make up 13% of the population, and of that, 77% of them are on welfare.
That's not correct on a lot of fronts.
But you see how this message resonates with Tea Party individuals. You mentioned polling. Well, Paul Street and Anthony DiMaggio wrote a great book called Crashing the Tea Party. And in that book, they empirically demonstrate how the Tea Party, who are vehemently anti-government, their anti-government views correlate with racial views because, again, the government has become a symbol for – people think that when they vote against the government, they're voting against minorities. And this goes back to, you know, Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty, how, once Lyndon Johnson tried to extend poverty, you know, beyond the New Deal programs and focus on minority poverty, then all of a sudden poverty became a symbol of government abuse, government only acting on behalf of minorities. And it's really unfortunate because people just have a real warped idea about welfare and about laziness. And this basically perpetuates the environment that we have ourselves in. And look, I don't give the Tea Party a pass. You know, everybody likes to say, oh, there's racist elements within the Tea Party and this and that. I don't believe that at all. I think you look at, for example, racist Google searches in America, right? You take the most racist anti-Obama Google searches and you look, and they're all in Tea Party areas. I mean, you've got Tea Party individuals like Dale Robertson, who was the founder of TeaParty.org. And this is a guy who was on the streets of Texas that has a sign that has the N-word on it. You could look at the first National Tea Party Convention where Sarah Palin and Tom Tancredo spoke favorably about literacy tests to the delight of the Tea Party audience, which was in Nashville, Tennessee, and everything. And so my point is that, and much of the opposition, I'm not a supporter of President Obama, much of the opposition to President Obama has been rooted in racism, unprecedented opposition that would never be directed towards a white president. I mean, I can give you dozens of examples, but an example that people forget is that one of the first things that President Obama did in 2009 was speak in front of children in their first day of class. And this, you know, conjured up so much reaction. This created so much controversy among white Americans, because the idea of a black man speaking to their children on the first day of school was just unprecedented to them. They were uncomfortable with it. And yet Ronald Reagan spoke to our nation's children about, you know, the importance of business growth and all this stuff. So racism is still alive and well. And you know what? I want to get your comment, Stu, on what we're seeing from, you know, police forces all across America, the shooting of unarmed black individuals, whether it's Trayvon Martin, whether it's this individual in Ferguson or others. What does that say about race relations and the subsequent media reaction to, you know, the demonizing of victims, as, you know, we saw in Trayvon Martin, as we're seeing here in the Ferguson case? What is your reaction to all this?
Well, a few things. Take on some of the things that you had said before. Not take on, but just to comment on them. I think there's a lot of interconnectedness here. Again, I think I'm not somebody who likes to talk too much about overt motives of any given group, just for generalization purposes. Plus, it often becomes an excuse to look past the actual things that people actually have to say. But the one thing that, implicit racism is a lot. It's going, I think it's past even the situation with dog whistles. You know, what the folks at Harvard and other places are sort of trying to cover is literally deep-seated, almost subconscious racist thought processes. And, you know, they do a test. I took it on the Harvard site, where they literally try and get you to react to various images with various connotations in, you know, less than a tenth of a second, so that they can get at some sort of subconscious pattern. And it's kind of hard to imagine a country that, you know, just 50 years ago was overtly, legally, blatantly racist, that those sentiments are weeded out. I think we're much better now than we were then. But if things have seeped into the subconscious, and if the image people pop into their head when they see an African-American young man in a hoodie is, you know, criminal, then you could imagine a lot of people who overtly are not racist doing pretty not good things because of the way that we've been conditioned. And I don't know how you get around that kind of conditioning, except hopefully in time. But I think it just knowing that it exists can be, you know, it can explain quite a bit. Even people who say, you know, I'm not an overt racist, and if you observe them, they wouldn't be. But what kind of things are lurking beneath the mental surface there? And that's why I think when you look in the aggregate, you don't ever hear about, you know, and maybe it's just not reported, but you don't ever hear about the you know, teenage white guy accidentally getting shot.
No. And
even if it was quote-unquote accidental, you got to ask, in the aggregate, why does it seem to always happen to African-Americans?
Yeah,
and I think go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, the racism that manifests itself, you know, overt racism, yeah, you have the Klan, yeah, you have white supremacist groups and whatnot, but they're marginalized, they're out in the fringe. But the racism among white America, which is still prevalent today, probably more so than it has been in a number of years. And I would say, yeah, on the surface, things have gotten better, but really they haven't gotten better. Racism has adapted, and this racism has manifested itself into, you know, what we're seeing, the support of a candidate who says that 47% of Americans are lazy and can't take personal responsibility. The support of shutting down the government, the support of questioning President Obama's birth certificate, all of these different things are indicators of racism and are.
Oh, I think there's definitely proxies there, as you say. I also, you know, part of me also goes back to, though, you know, there's other elements that can, you know, do I think Mitt Romney is a racist? And you could never know. But one thing that, you know, you have this other strand of sort of the Ayn Rand thing going on. And that, whether it's, concurrent with racism or independent of it, certainly feeds into the mindset. And part of it, and, you know, I've thought about writing about this. I don't know. You know, I think that there's something for the left and the right when they do battle over, you know, what the Constitution was and wasn't. I think a lot of people ignore the degree to which even the framers, right, and some of them were certainly racist.
Yes.
Worried about the tyranny of the local majority in the states, in the cities, over a minority. Now, the minority group that they were worried about, by all indications, specifically, would have been property holders. But the principle still applies to other groups. And I think that gets lost in these folks who say, I want to return to what the original intent was. The original intent was to take power away from the states. And the justification for taking the power away from the states was that it was easier for a local majority to tyrannize a local minority. I think history bears that out, especially if you're an African American. And that's a tradition in the history of American sort of constitutional thought that I think it's lost. Now, I will say this, though, for the folks on liberal folks, I think that people who say that the Tea Party are really more descendants of the anti-federalists than the folks who created the Constitution are probably right. But what they ignore is the degree to which anti-federalist thought fed into the creation of the Constitution, especially in the Bill of Rights. So there's, you know, everybody has claim to that sort of tradition, but I really do think people ignore, and to go back to the original point, the tyranny of the local majority over the local minority is something that is the tradition in that the African Americans have experienced in inordinate amounts of ways for centuries.
Exactly.
So when you say to me, states, even if you're, if you're opposed to, you know, central government, you know, you're opposing a tradition that not, you know, in your mind has always been, you know, and you're not yours, I mean, the mind of Tea Parties is always associated with the loss of liberty and the loss of rights. But if you know African American history or the history of other minority groups, the central government has often been the one who, at the end of the day, has had to come often kicking and screaming because of what the activists in those groups, minority groups, have done to the defense of the local minority against the local majority.
Still, we've got 30
seconds
left.
And so when you have an ideology that's anti-central government, it often is, by just association, part of the problem if you're a minority group.
That's very, very well put. Very, very good point. All right, real quickly, 10 seconds. Give people information how they could find your work and everything.
Okay, the number one thing you could do, go to Justice for King. That's Justice, F-O-R-K-I-N-G, on Twitter. And you will find in my tweet, even in the logo at the top, all sorts of ways you can support my Indiegogo campaign, the contest today from Docurama, links to get books and stuff if you want to get them, But again, my goal is it's just so I hope people understand this. It's more to generate public pressure and public support to try and get some of these cases readdressed than it is to make money. But obviously, in the way things work, you need some money for crowdfunding, for instance, to try and get that public pressure out there. So Justice for King on Twitter would be, or you can find me on Facebook, and it would be Stuart Westler, S-T-U-A-R-T. Maybe I'll provide some links to you, and I very much appreciate
Beautiful.
Any help anybody could give.
Stu, we got to get you back on the program for a whole discussion about race relations in America, because that was we got a lot of response in the chat room, a lot of people out there listening, and we can go on for a long time. So thank you very much, Stu. I appreciate it.
Thank you. That was great.
Take care, brother.